there's any parents here that have children ages 4 to 7, and if you wish, you can keep them here or you can take them to Stepping Stones, room 1, first on the left. Today we're talking about faith, and we're talking about faith from the chapter probably most well known for faith, Hebrews 11. But I think if we were honest, most of us say that our grip on this idea of faith is probably a little fuzzy. And so we're going to take some time to look at what it means and then see how that fits with what we see in Hebrews chapter 11. So let's start with a dictionary definition of faith. You'll put that first slide up. Faith is belief and trust in God. And kind of following on that idea of faithful also means being loyal to God. Faith is belief and trust in God. Now, that's good as far as it goes, but it does not fully express the biblical concept of faith. Our society has made faith into a purely mental exercise where we can say, I believe something, and I stick it on the shelf in my brain, and it has nothing to do with how I live. And you and I have been affected to some degree or another by this. So as we look at this, we're going to first read the passage we have, the verses, Hebrews 11, verses 1 to 6, and then we're going to dig a little bit deeper. So remain seated, but let's read from the screen. Hebrews 11, verses 1 to 6. Now faith is the assurance of things hoped for, the conviction of things not seen. For by it the people of old received their commendation. By faith we understand that the universe was created by the word of God, so that what is seen was not made out of things that are visible. By faith, Abel offered to God a more acceptable sacrifice than Cain, through which he was commended as righteous, God commending him by accepting his gifts. And through his faith, though he died, he still speaks. By faith, Enoch was taken up so that he should not see death, and he was not found because God had taken him. Now before he was taken, he was commended as having pleased God. And without faith, it is impossible to please him, for whoever would draw near to God must believe that he exists and that he rewards those who seek him. Now, contrary to what we hear in our popular culture today, everybody exercises faith. In our thinking, in our culture today, Western thought, faith is optional. It is put in a realm with other personal, subjective values such as feelings, beauty, religion, and truth. And in these, for example, in terms of like looking at beauty, there are differing views on what is beautiful and what is not. Today, you hear people talk about, you got your truth, I got my truth. They don't have to agree. They can be different. Faith is in that camp that is placed there, and it is sometimes called blind faith, implying that faith is baseless. Something you can have, but it's baseless. In this view, so you've got the one side, kind of the fuzzy thing with beauty and faith and feelings and religion. On the other side, in this picture, you've got fact and science that's solid and dependable. Well, to quote a Southern saying, that view of these two ways of looking at life just doesn't hold water. You ever tried carrying a lot of water in your hand? It just doesn't work. Well, this view does not hold water. First, not using the current understanding we have of truth, the way it's claimed to be understood, but looking at the idea of truth as we've had it for thousands of years, the idea that you can have a truth and I can have a different truth that conflicts and that we can both be happy and make them all work just doesn't make any sense. Let me give you an example. I'm going to turn around so we're both going in the same direction. We've all been taught in our truth, this is right. But if we take this idea, I could say, well, you know what? For me, my truth is this is right. And so if I give you directions, so yeah, you go here and here, and at this corner you turn right to get where you're going. And if you follow my directions, what's going to happen? you're going to get lost. Also, faith is not optional. Faith is behind everything we do. We looked at that dictionary definition. Faith includes belief and trust, but it's also the basis for our decisions. For example, all of you are sitting in a chair, most of you comfortably. Some of you are going to get very comfortable in the chair. So comfortable, you're tempted to drift off. Okay? Do you realize that you sitting in the chair, you have exercised your faith in that chair, that it will hold you? Now, a good number of us, maybe not everybody, has had the occasion where you went to sit in something and you thought it was going to hold you and you realized as soon as you got on it, no, it's not going to hold me, it's not stable. What do? You get up and find someplace else to sit. And if there is no other place and you're going to sit there, you're not sitting comfortably. You're just kind of waiting for what's going to happen next. You're not trusting that. But our faith isn't just in physical things. All of us, every one of us, have a way of looking at life that's based on faith. You could call it a worldview if you want. In this, people base their expectations. We make decisions. We make plans based on what we put our faith in. Let me give you two examples. Some people believe that money brings happiness. And they then shape their life around that idea. They make their career choices. They make other choices in their life based on this idea, money brings happiness. They have expectations and they build their plans based on that. Other people say, you know what, I believe the practice of a particular religion will ensure a good life for me and a happy eternity. And so they then build their life around that particular religion, and they have expectations that come with it, and they make plans and make decisions based on where they've put their faith. All of us put our faith into practice, and that's what's not made clear in the dictionary definition. And that's what you see in the Bible and in Hebrews chapter 11 in particular. These people put their faith into practice. So let's look at verse 1. Faith is the assurance of things hoped for, the conviction of things not seen. That word hope there doesn't mean how we often use it, wish. We say, oh, I hope it doesn't rain this afternoon. That's a wish. No, here, hope is an expectation. It's something you depend upon. So you could read the beginning of verse 1 as faith is being sure of what you expect to happen. There's a sense of certainty. The second part, faith is the conviction of things not seen yet. But you have a conviction. It's going to happen. It will work. You and I live on the basis of our convictions. We make decisions and plans based on what we are confident will happen. But if you kind of stop and think, you realize that faith is future-looking. It's future-looking, and it shapes our views and our choices today. See, the view is one, or the future is 1 minute from now. Future is this afternoon. It's 1 year from now. It is 20 years from now. You could say that all of us live our life walking into the future, and we don't know what's going to happen. But do we place our faith in ideas, in people, in things? Do we exercise that? Yes, we do. You might hear today, all that matters is that you believe. Well, yes, we do believe, but there's more to it. You see, a key aspect of faith is not how much faith you have, but who or what you put your faith in. I heard another pastor give this example. He talked about two people, each are going to climb a ladder. First person has complete confidence in their ladder. You can tell it by the way they start up the step, up the rungs of the ladder. The only problem is it's a wooden ladder and it's rotten. And halfway up, it falls apart. And they crash to the ground. They have complete confidence. Second person has their ladder, and it's set up, and they have confidence enough. They're climbing it, but it's not a really strong confidence, kind of more like with fear and trembling, and they're, you know, have a good grip. they're totally secure. Why? Because their ladder is in great shape. It's not going to fall apart. So it isn't just a matter of how much faith you have, but where have you placed it? It makes a big difference. In the Bible, we're told that the ultimate object of our faith is to be God. God the Father, Son, and Spirit. Not just his person, but what God has done and what God has already promised that he will do. Now, I just made the case that you and I exercise our faith all the time. We put our faith in people and in things. But God tells us that if we have faith in God, the God of the Bible, that's not something you and I come up with on our own. You put up the next slide. In Ephesians 2, 8 and 9, we're told, "For by grace," that word grace is related to the idea of gift, "for by grace you have been saved through faith, and this is not your own doing, it is the gift of God, not as a result of works, so that no one may boast." So, as you look at this, it's talking about salvation, or you could use the word rescue, that God's going to rescue us, and that happens through faith, we're given faith. What we see is that both of those, the rescue and the faith, are gifts from God. And that makes sense when you see how the Bible talks about us and the nature that you and I are born with. We are born with a nature that either ignores God altogether, we turn it back, we say he doesn't exist, or yeah, he may be there, but I don't need him. Or we take God and we try to make him into the God we want him to be. God, you're going to do this, this, and this for me. And be right ready, on call, anytime I need you. Rather than looking at God as the God who is, the God who shows himself in the Bible and shows himself today. That's verse 1. In verse 2, the writer points back to the Old Testament, which he does all the way through the book of Hebrews, to people, some people that we're going to look at in just a minute. And then verse 3. Verse 3 says, "By faith we understand that the universe was created by the word of God, so that what is seen was not made out of things that are visible." I'm so glad the writer put that in, because that is a verse that we need today very much. So let's take just a minute and look at it. Some people today claim that evolution is fact, based on science. Now remember what I said before. They have that view. You have fact and science, it's solid, dependable. Then you have faith and religion and these other things that are soft and fuzzy and dismissible. And so the claim is evolution is based on fact, solid, faith. A belief in creation is faith, and so that's optional, it's dismissible. But when you look carefully at the claims of creation and the theory of evolution, what you see is that they're both matters of faith. Both of them. In college, I was trained in the sciences and in engineering, and it was drilled into me. Science is based on what is observable, repeatable, and verifiable. Thank you. So, you look at this room. How is it that we can have such a large open area? That's because we have scissor trusses in the roof, allow us to span this distance and have this open space. That's based on science. The cars you drive, the cell phones you have, they're based on science. Evolution says that matter is eternal. Is there any way for anybody to verify that matter is eternal? Any of us? No, you can't. There was no human being present to witness creation, but God was there. And we have his story, his witness, and he tells us about it. So it was observed, but if you think about it, creation of the universe is a one-time act. So it's not repeatable. So that right there takes both creation and evolution out of the realm of science. However, science is not silent. In the last 50 to 60 years, we've had this huge explosion of advances in science and what we've been able to see and learn. And some of those areas have to do with us being able to get down into cells, cellular level, and see what is happening there and how things work. Evolution says that life began as the simplest living organism that came into being by chance from non-living things, something happened and poof, you had life. And then progressively, that simple living organism became more and more complex. Science today lets us look into the inner workings of living organisms much, much deeper than we could 30, 40 years ago. And what scientists are seeing, they're seeing the intricacy and what many call the irreducible complexity of living organisms, mechanisms that occur that on cellular level that they say there's no way for this function and this function that we see working and fitting together to have been separate and be brought together by accident. The odds are so great, it's impossible. There must be a designer. Doesn't mean that they all believe in the God of the Bible. They say, no, there has to be a designer. The other thing that we see with, again, with the advances in technology is we've been able to see about genetic information in the cells. And what scientists have discovered is that over generations, we lose genetic information. We don't gain it. And if you're going to go from a simple organism to a complex one, you have to gain information. It's just not there. So what we see in the world around us, what we see through science, to me, validates creation and raises questions about the theory of evolution. But why do I bring it up? Because what you think about the origin of life, whether it was evolution or some other mechanism that does not require God, realize that makes God optional, totally. And then on the other side, if creation is true, God is not only the source of life, but that means he's still involved today, and we have to do with him. And that makes a big difference on how you work out your life, how you sort out how life is to be lived. Let's look at verse 6, and then we'll turn to the people listed called the Hall of Faith. Verse 6, without faith, it is impossible to please him, that is, please God. For whoever would draw near to God must believe that he exists and that he rewards those who seek him. Well, let's kind of drill down through this with a few questions. First, why would we want to please God? Well, he tells us he's our creator. He's our king, our ruler. And he tells us he's the one who rescues us from our own foolishness, stubbornness, and rebellion. That's a good reason to want to please him, because all the good gifts that he gives us. It's related to what we were doing earlier when we were confessing, and not just confessing our own failures, but confessing God's goodness. Second, what other attitudes can people have towards God? The one that we see here, one that we're commanded in the Bible, is to love God and to please him. Another attitude is to ignore him. Many people just say, you know what? I don't need a God. Just doesn't fit with how I want to see life go. Or do you hate him? You've ever read about Martin Luther? He's a young man that went to college studying to become a lawyer. He had this life-changing experience. Instead, he ended up in a monastery. And at one point, he was asked by one of the other monks, Brother Martin, do you love God? And his answer, love God? I hate him. And he was being serious. That's kind of an odd thing for a monk to say, isn't it? Well, when he came into the monastery, he brought his legal training with him. And he saw in the Bible the Ten Commandments, God's laws, the obligations that we have to God, and he saw his own failure. He didn't see an answer from God, so in his view, God was being very demanding, and he felt hopeless. And he drove his confessors crazy. Because what he was taught was, here's how you deal with your sin. You go to the priest and you confess. Well, he didn't confess for 5 or 10 minutes. He confessed for 30 or 40 or for 2 hours. I would bet, now we don't know this, speculation, that behind the scenes, the guys are drawing straws. Who gets the short straw today? Why? Why did he keep coming? Because when he walked away from the confession booth, he still had his guilt with him. Just confessing it to the priest didn't fix it. But a little bit later, God opens his eyes as he's reading the Bible, and he realizes as he's reading the New Testament and reading about the good news, the gospel, that what God requires of us, God also provides. And from that point on, if he was ever asked, do you love God? Oh, I love God. Boy, do I love God. Let me tell you how I love God. What's your attitude? How do we please God? Well, remember, we're working our way through the book of Hebrews, that these writers have been talking about this covenant, which is shorthand for covenant relationship. And the core of the covenant is relationship. So how do you please God? You live life with God every day. You involve him. You talk with God. You depend upon God. You delight in God and you obey him. It's the same type of thing that you do with people that you want to be in relationship with. Talking and listening and delighting in them. All of that. Now, this chapter is called by many the Hall of Faith. And as Bruce was saying, you have these people that the writer lists, and in every case, they put their faith in God, and their faith in God shaped how they lived. We just read about a couple of them in the verses that we had. Abel. Cain and Abel were the sons of Adam and Eve. And we're told that Abel offered a better offering, a better sacrifice. Now, when you go back and read in Genesis about the two of them, you see that Abel raised animals and Cain was a farmer. So some people have concluded that God likes offerings when it's meat, and he doesn't like vegetables. Okay, a lot of kids would agree with that part. Okay, but no, that's not the case. The better offering was talking about the giver and not the gift. And you see the evidence of that when you see how Cain responds when God doesn't accept his offering like he did Abel's. He gets angry and kills the competition, literally. Better is talking about the giver than Enoch. It says that Enoch walked with God. That's talking about relationship. He lived his life with God, and God chose that Enoch would not die physically. So in Genesis, you get your first hint of resurrection. And then Noah. When you read in Genesis about God coming to Noah, God starts off by saying that he looked at the whole world and the thoughts of men were only evil continually. There he's not saying that they were as bad as they could be, but they had all either turned away from God or were trying to make God into their what they wanted him to be rather than who he was. And God comes to Noah and speaks to him, and God gives Noah faith. And you know that Noah has faith because his project took over 100 years to complete. Building the ark. But he didn't just build the ark. We're told in the New Testament that he preached, he proclaimed, he talked to people. And I would be surprised if he didn't have a whole bunch of people come and say, Noah, what are you building in your backyard? This monster thing, 45 feet tall, 300 feet long, longer, 75 feet wide. It's an ark. What's that, a boat? Well, why do we need a boat? Because there's going to be a flood. We've never had a flood before. Well, God has come to me and he's promised. He sees us and how we have turned away from him. And he says that he is going to destroy the world with a flood. But there is our rescue. Right there. And what you see as the story unfolds is that nobody else believed him. Only Noah, his three sons, and their wives were in the ark. And I believe there's room in the ark for lots of other people. They all said, I don't think it's going to happen. And then Abraham and Sarah. God comes to Abraham. I want a relationship with you. First, I want you to leave your family. I want you to leave all that is familiar and secure. And he did. What you see in these people is faith in action. Now, they're not perfect. We're going to talk about that in a minute. But you see their faith in action by what they did. Put up the next slide. In Hebrews 11, verse 13, the writer says this, pauses after Abraham. These all died in faith, not having received the things promised, but having seen them and greeted them from afar, and having acknowledged that they were strangers and exiles on the earth. What is he talking about? Well, the one thing he is not saying is this. He is not saying, oh yeah, God made a lot of promises and he didn't keep them. God did. God promised Noah after the flood. He said, I will never flood the earth, the entire world again. And he hasn't. God promised to bless and protect Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And God did. Well, let's just look at Abraham. God also had promised Abraham, he said, I'm going to make you into a nation, and I'm going to give your descendants the land you're living in, the land of Canaan. Well, when Abraham died, there was Abraham, son Isaac, and two grandsons. That's it. Abraham didn't see with his eyes the nation. When Abraham died, the only land that he owned was a burial plot for his wife. That was it. Yet, you read on, and God made him into a nation of people, and he gave them the land many years later. But here's the other thing that the writer is doing. He's pointing back to a couple of promises like that. But earlier in the book, as he works his way to chapter 11, he's been building this case that God's ultimate promise, his ultimate promise, is Jesus. And for all of the people that he talks about in chapter 11, Jesus is future. They're trusting that God is going to take care of things, that God is going to restore what's been broken, that God is the one who's going to reconcile, make right their relationship with God. And he's the one who's going to take care of that. And all those people in the Old Testament didn't see Jesus. They knew that God had promised something. They didn't know exactly how God was going to answer it. But he goes on to say that they are strangers and exiles. These people in this relationship with God realize that this earth, the life that they lived and you and I live, this is not our final home. That God is going to give Christians, people who are trusting in him and have faith in him, a new heaven and a new earth, one with no brokenness in it. Let's take just a minute and look at some of the people that are mentioned in the chapter. There's Isaac and Jacob, Joseph, Moses, and other people like Samson, Gideon, and Barak. Now, he lists some names, and there's other people he refers to without giving their names. And yes, as you look at them, you're going to see that in each one of their cases, you see faith in God in action. But you also look at the list and you kind of come from the other side and you got to wonder, what was this guy's criteria? Okay, as he puts these people in here. Some of them you'd say, oh, Abraham, oh yes, he's a great man. Moses, great man. Samson, some of these others, what's going on? Well, here's part of what I think is in play here that we don't often talk about. As we look in the Old Testament, we see some of their history. And we see the way they lived. And we see, yes, there were times where they were right there listening to God, walking with him, doing what he said. And there are other times they did not listen and they failed. And it was sometimes big failures. Big failures. For example, Isaac and Jacob. Isaac is Abraham's son. Jacob is one of his twin sons. Isaac deliberately disobeys God and tries to give his inheritance to his oldest son, Esau. Why? Because he and his wife were playing favorites. If you want to get this in more detail, I did a sermon series not too long ago about Jacob and covered all this. Isaac and Rebekah, his wife, played favorites. They were twin boys. Esau was older by a few minutes, and then Jacob. Isaac's favorite was Esau. Rebekah's favorite was Jacob. God had told them, Isaac and Rebekah, before the boys were born, the younger one gets the inheritance. But Esau was Isaac's favorite. And so he's said, look, I'm the head of the house. I'm going to do what I want. I'm going to give the inheritance to my older son. The only reason that Jacob ended up actually getting the inheritance was because Jacob deceived his father. And he got it. And then when you look at Jacob's life, he takes favoritism up to a whole new level with his family. And boy, does he trouble his family. Moses, look at him. God used him to lead the people. Yes, but before any of that happened, Moses murdered a man. He was going to lead the people out his way. Samson. Who would ever look at Samson as a role model? Son, when you grow up, I want you to be just like Samson. No. You're going to say, no, no, no. Uh-uh. No. And then Gideon. God almost had to twist Gideon's arm to get him to do what he told him to do. Gideon's the one with the fleece, the test. God, let me make really, really sure it's you. Okay, would you do this? Now, would you do the opposite? Now, would you take the two and turn it around and do it again? What do you know I see in this? There are no stellar, unblemished examples of faith in this list. Now, one of the things that preachers have a bad habit of doing is taking one of these people like Abraham or Jacob or somebody else and say, oh yes, he had faults, but he's a hero of the faith. Just work real hard and you can become like him. Now that leaves all the work for us to do. And we already recognize, if we're honest with ourselves, our own failures. Now in this we see no stellar, unblemished examples. We see people like you and me that God came and had a relationship with, that God gave faith, that God used, that God protected and cared about. That's what we see. And what we also see is it isn't the amount of faith that you have in God. That doesn't make one person better than another. It's that you and I respond to God in faith at all. Even if, as Jesus says, you only have faith as small as a mustard seed. Well, how small is that? Take your news bits, your bulletin, find a period. That's about the size of a mustard seed. Okay? That's pretty small. And Jesus says, that's enough. It's just like the guy climbing the ladder who's not confident. He's going, yes, slowly, carefully. Is there faith there? Yes, there is. Is it a lot? No. But it's enough. But that kind of moves us then to the man that talked with Jesus in the New Testament and said, Lord, I believe, help my unbelief. Okay, I believe you're real. I believe what you said is true. But I need you working here. And so as we look at this list, we see people who, very imperfect, yet put their faith in God into action. And as they were putting their faith in God in action, they were listening to God and they were obeying Him. They were holding on to God's promises. They were depending on God and they were living in relationship with God. Think about just one example for a second. Gideon. I was making a little fun of him. You read his story, okay, the last person you'd think to be a hero. The people of Israel are living in a time where they're not listening to God. They've turned their backs on God, and God's made their life hard. Other surrounding nations let them grow their crops, do all the things they do for business, and they sweep in and steal it. And so at this point, Gideon is in a hole in the ground trying to thresh some wheat. He's trying to separate the wheat and the chaff so he has some wheat that he can make bread with. But it's in a hole in the ground so he can't be seen. And the angel of the Lord comes to him and calls him, oh, mighty warrior. God has a sense of humor. And then you have the fleeces and the tests and everything. And so Gideon puts out the call. Now think about it. As soon as he put out the call for men to come and gather around him, he put a target on his head. Because these enemy troops, people that came in with tens of thousands, 100,000 people, 100,000 men, they're going to come through and just very systematically steal all the food and everything from the people. He's got 10, I forget the number. It was over 10,000 people. And God says, too many. And God narrows it down to 300. And he doesn't stop. Now, is he uncertain? Yes. And so what does God do? He says, sneak up and listen. So he takes a friend of his and they go up and they sneak up and they're listening to two guards guarding the enemy camp. And he hears the guards talking. And one says to the other, "Hey, you know what? I had a dream." And Gideon recognizes the dream. It was God's confirmation. "I'm going to do this for you." And so those 300 men, okay, it was a good example today. They had a trumpet, okay, kind of like what Bruce has. And they had a torch covered. And they spread out around the camp. And when Gideon gives the word, they take the pot off. It was a pottery pot off of the torch. They smash it, and then they start blowing the trumpet. And God totally confuses the army, and they start killing each other. And then the 300 chase them. 300 are chasing 100,000, and the 300 win. Okay? That's faith in action. Now, God doesn't call you and I to gather 300 people and try to rout a group like that. He has other ways that he challenges us. Yeah, just like he gave Gideon the faith to listen and obey and follow through, God also gives us faith. The writer goes on at the end of the chapter to help us see more clearly that faith in God led both to victories and to suffering. He doesn't actually mention the names of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, three young Jewish men that had lived in Israel and were taken by force by the Babylonian army to Babylon. And they get in trouble with King Nebuchadnezzar because he builds a big statue and says, "Everybody in my kingdom has to bow down and worship this statue," and they refuse. And so if you know the story, you know that it's told that he's going to throw them into a furnace. A furnace is a room-sized fire pit. And he gets angry. He says, "I want that thing as hot as it can be." And he made it so hot that the guards that are carrying them and throwing them in die from the heat. And nothing happens to them. They just walk around. And when they come out, there's not even any smoke smell at all. That's a victory. There's also suffering. And God makes it very plain in the Bible that his plans for us include both. Victories at times and some suffering in different ways. And the writer ends the chapter by going back to the ultimate promise, Jesus. That's what the whole book is about, is Jesus. Because when we get to chapter 12, just like Bruce was quoting a little bit from it, it's going to go back again to Jesus. And what he says at the end is that our hope, our rescue, God's ultimate plan was accomplished both for the Old Testament people and for us through the life, death, and resurrection of Jesus. So, you have faith, and it's in action. How do you know who or what you put your faith in? Our choices, our actions show who and what we put our faith in. Is your faith in God? If so, as you walk into the future, you can have confidence. But just like many of the people that are listed in Hebrews 11, we can also ask God, "God, I know you've worked in the past in my life. Would you please continue? I need you every day." Maybe you're here today and you say, "You know what? No, I haven't ever put my faith in God." Not like you're talking about. If you haven't, ask God to make himself real to you, because he is real. And ask him to give you that faith. That's the good news. There isn't some set bar that we have to reach. There isn't some set of standards that we have to meet. You have to be able to do this and do that in order for God to pay attention to you at all. Now, when you and I turn to God and say, "God, I don't have anything to offer, but you offer something. You offer this gift of faith in you. You offer the gift of a relationship that'll go on for forever." Ask him to show you what that looks like and what it means. Let's pray. Lord, I thank you for this chapter and for the people that are in it. I thank you for what you say about faith and the fact that you're the one who gives us faith in you. Lord, I pray that as we go through this day, this week, that you'd remind us of that question. Where am I putting my faith right now? Who? Yes, there's the people and the things that we do put our faith in everyday life, but ultimately, is my faith in you. And Lord, I thank you that you prompt us to ask the question and you give us the answer, and it's Jesus. We pray all this in Christ's name. Amen. Please remain seated, and we're going to finish with a song.